Good afternoon, everybody. Good evening. What is it? Afternoon or evening? 4 o'clock. This time of year, 4 o'clock starts to feel like evening. But anyway, thanks to all of you for being here. I know we're all looking forward to hearing from Mark. Our speaker this month is Mark Sawin, who's going to be talking to us about some work he did when he was on his sabbatical. Whenever I do an introduction of someone from within our community, I pull out the CV and I review it to see if there's anything new there that I didn't know. I think often we think we know each other pretty well and there's nothing surprising. Well, I did find something surprising. Here's the facts. Mark graduated from Goshen College in 1993 and from University of Texas at Austin in, what was it, 2000? 2001. But here's something new. He served as a contributing editor to Chef Magazine for 3 years back in the 1990s. So try to get a dinner invitation to his house. In any case, Mark, you're among friends, but welcome. We're looking forward to hearing what you have to say.
All right. Oh, wow. I can't see anybody. This is exciting. Okay. So this is a project that's been going on for some time. Several years ago, Howard Zaire, right after he retired from here, though he hasn't really left us, wanted to do a project that was fun and asked me to come join him on a project about Virginians and their pickups. Several of you here in the audience, like Bill, are actually in this book with his pickup. And that was a lot of fun. I was supposed to write an essay at the end of the book to explain why Americans love pickup trucks. And that seemed like a pretty easy question. I just hopped on, as a good academic, hopped onto the academic sources and went to pull down articles on why Americans love pickup trucks, and there weren't any, which strikes me as really odd to this day. There's still really nothing on sort of Americans' obsessions with trucks. And so it's sort of become my obsession. So I've moved from sort of researching this book for this book to other things. And so that's why I'm going to take you through this journey here today. I've come to some conclusions. I'm not sure how confident I am in them, but I'm feeling more and more confident. So here we go. So first off, just the history of the pickup truck. And when I presented with Howard several years ago, I would have told you all this. I knew this back then. The pickup truck starts in really 1918. Ford introduces a truck. And then after World War I, that has a body that they call the runabout with pickup body. So that's where the term pickup comes from. And shortly thereafter, the other U.S. manufacturers began modeling this style as well. And these became fairly popular for the rural folks of the time, which was a whole lot of America in the 1920s. At that time period, only 1% of America's roads were paved, and 6.5 million farmers, farm families in America. And so this vehicle was very much constructed for them. It's basically a hay wagon, a small hay wagon attached to a vehicle that you can fit a couple passengers into. But what happens then, of course, is the demographics of the United States change pretty dramatically. Right about the time that you see this cross between rural and urban is when the pickup's invented. And from that point forward, rural population drops and urban population increases. Or looking here in the 1920s, by this time, actually, agricultural workers had dropped pretty significantly. It was down to only 10% of the American population. Industrial workers were still quite high. That continues to drop. The service industry was just starting to take off. So given these trends, it would make sense that pickup truck sales would drop, and they did. From the 1920s through the 1950s, and really into the 1960s, pickup truck sales compared to the population declined because America was obsessed with cars. The big three were the big three. American cars were a love affair for Americans. We built the huge highway system starting in 1956, and there was a massive love affair with the car. What happens, of course, course, in the 1970s is thanks to OPEC restricting oil over issues in the Middle East and a downward spiral that becomes stagflation under the Nixon administration. What you wind up with is a gas shortage and a real crisis in the American automotive industry, because the American automotive industry didn't catch on to what the global auto industry did catch on to, and that was that bigger wasn't better. This is when Honda and Toyota start to show up in the United States. Before this time, Honda had been a motorcycle manufacturer here. That's about it. Shout out to Mario. Where's Mario? I can't see here. There he is. He just wrote a paper for me last semester on the rise of Japanese cars in America, so I'm stealing blatantly from him for this. But what happens here is that the Americans' auto industry keeps cranking out these huge cars. These are all ads from 1976, whereas Honda and then Toyota really figure out that these small, simple cars, right? Those of you who are older remember, you know, Honda, we make it simple. Like, that was just the idea of the simple, basic car that was very fuel efficient and still handy with a big hatchback, so you could put a lot of things into it still. And this takes off. The U.S. policy in terms of how you finance or how you process money coming into the country shifts in 1965, which makes it easier to import cars. And so foreign car sales start to jump, climbing up to 60,000 by 1979. But to put this in terms of today, it's nice that the year just ended. So all the 2017 numbers have just been processed. For 2017, imports made up 75% of car sales in the United States. 6.3 million cars purchased, 75% of those were foreign manufactured. The big three in terms of autos are Toyota, Honda, and Nissan. That's who sells by far the most autos. GM is playing pretty good, so is Ford. Notice that Chrysler's number 12. Several other Japanese and Korean companies, German companies, are high ranking. And so really Asian manufacturers and European manufacturers have captured the U.S. car industry. We only make about 25% of our cars here in the United States. But that would have meant death, honestly, to the U.S. auto market, and it largely did for several corporations, right? A lot of these companies really struggled in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, and up to the 2008 crash, where you have to have bailouts as well. But what you wind up with is the auto industry being saved by a new types of vehicles that are still big. And so though Americans are buying a lot of small gas-efficient sedans, mostly from foreign manufacturers, they start buying cars that are very practical for American lives. And so in the 80s, the rise of the minivan takes off. The SUV follows shortly thereafter, or actually sort of simultaneously. And these become the hot vehicles of the 80s and the 90s. As we move into the 2000s, the crossover vehicle has taken off. That's like the Subaru Outback and other vehicles sort of like that that are bigger than a station wagon and all-wheel drive, which is important because by being all-wheel drive, the EPA classifies them as a truck, which lowers their gas standards that they have to fit into. So this is what has sort of helped save the U.S. auto market. And so these vehicles make sense. Like, it's not surprising that these sales went up because, right, they match what Americans want. You can go to Walmart, fill up the back of it. You can hold your kids and their friends and your dog. This is a smart vehicle. The other vehicle that's smart and that has taken off is the hybrid. And here at EMU, right, I feel like we see a lot of Priuses around here especially. And those sales have taken off over the past few years. But just to put it in context, if you rank the top-selling vehicles in the United States, all hybrid and electric vehicles fall between place number 23 and 24, just behind the Toyota Tacoma truck and just above the Subaru, which one is that? Forester. So still not a major portion of our market. What has surprised me, and this is the big shocking thing that I figured out when I started to research for this book, and it was what I talked a lot about when I presented this last time, was this chart. And I've updated it up through to 2017 numbers here. So if you look at auto sales from 1950 to the present, they look like that. If you look at light truck sales, they look like this. If you look at the number of people working in agriculture and jobs that when I was doing a quick survey, I decided you might need a pickup truck for, they look like this. And so what happens, of course, here is it's not intuitive. As the number of people who, in theory, would need a pickup truck has fallen, the number of people who own a pickup truck has increased, or a truck has increased. And starting in 1999, truck sales passed car sales, and they've been ahead of car sales 17 out of the last 19 years. And this past year, light truck sales made up 63% of the new auto sales in America, compared to only 36% auto sales. So breaking this down, I'm sorry, lots of stats here. Total car market made up 36.8%. Most of those were import. 27% of all the cars were imported cars. In terms of trucks, mostly domestic trucks. 35% of the market was domestic trucks. Now, what you can see here, and I don't know how much you want to geek out on this like I have, but car sales are just plummeting all the way across. People aren't buying cars. Look at large cars. In December, in last month, in all of the United States, 18 large cars sold. Sucks to be a salesman for a Lincoln Continental right now. That's all I'm saying. But what's growing is crossovers, which makes sense. These cars match sort of how Americans work. Notice that minivans are very out of style now. And what it switched to are these small SUVs, luxury SUVs, which tend to be small SUVs, and then these crossovers, these four-wheel drive, larger station wagons. That's what's been popular. But the other number that keeps climbing is still pickup trucks. So we're still buying more and more pickup trucks. And when you look at the numbers in terms of the absolute best sellers, this is especially shocking. So though truck sales include SUVs and crossovers, the Ford F-Series pickup has been the best-selling vehicle in America since 1982. Every month since 1982, the Ford F-150 has been the best-selling vehicle in America. And for the last two decades, also in the top five have been the Chevy Silverado and the Dodge Ram. And so these three models alone accounted for 2 million sales last year. To put it in another way, Americans bought these three vehicles at the rate of 225 per hour, 24/7, 365 last year. Or to put it another way, we spent $55 billion on these three vehicles last year. So this is a huge chunk of the market in American automotive sales. And this seems crazy because these aren't vehicles that most Americans need. The Toyota Camry, that makes sense. The Nissan Rogue also makes sense. But these top three don't make sense in terms of if we're purely looking at what does somebody need from their vehicle. Now, I like to do this, and I was hoping some Canadians would be here. Are there any Canadians? Canadians usually feel self-righteous because they're usually better than we are. In this case, they're not. Which I'm happy about. You can see here that crossover sales are really still climbing. But yes, in Canada, it's just as bad. These are the top 10 sales from 2017. They're also buying lots of great big pickup trucks. So that's my question. Why? Why are Americans and Canadians buying boatloads of pickup trucks? Actually, it's not boatloads because they're not being hauled over. They're being made here. Okay. So first, my first question was who in America is buying these pickup trucks? And that's pretty clear. Actually, demographics on cars are really tough to get. The two companies that track this stuff are both for-profit companies who do research and want to sell you their data at very high prices. So I was relying on MarketWatch and the Wall Street Journal and a couple other resources who buy these numbers and convert them and use them for journalistic purposes. So what MarketWatch said was this. Women typically choose small SUVs and compact cars, and they tend toward Asian manufactured nameplates like Toyota and Hyundai that have a reputation for good quality and dependability. Men tend to see vehicles as a reflection on their own identity. They tend to buy pickups and foreign American pickups and foreign cars, American truck brands and European luxury brands especially. If you break down which vehicles are bought at the highest percentage by men, it's these. So the GMC Sierras, which is a pickup, the Ford F-Series, the Silverados, Ford Rangers, Toyota Tundras, Dodge Rams, all pickups. They also buy the European sports cars at far higher numbers. The cars that women buy a higher portion of are the VW Beetle was way up there, and smaller practical vehicles. So pickups are purchased by men, by and large. Now, so I started to look at what trends would account for why men are buying so many pickup trucks. So I did want to sort of examine how masculinity, how gender has started to shift or changed in other ways in the United States. And that's pretty easy to show. Since the 1960s, you've seen there's been a big decline and still a continuing decline that sort of leveled off of what are called primary jobs, meaning farmers, miners, people who actually pull things from the earth or do things with physical things. Extraction jobs, they sometimes call them. The other category is industrial sorts of jobs. These are people who take those raw materials and turn them into other things and haul them around. Those jobs, since the 1960s, have also declined. What's kept going up is service jobs. And so the two most heavily female jobs, teaching and nursing, have become increasingly important and have continued to climb. The most dominant male jobs, which had been a lot of the factory working jobs, have been perpetually declining. And so what you start to see is the rise in dual income households. This is for other purposes as well. But you can see that between 1960 and 2010, the number of families that are headed by just the man or that are just have the man working has dropped from 70 to 31%, whereas dual income families has jumped from 25 to 60. In terms of who's getting an education, women have passed men and indeed are staying quite far ahead. 2017 was a landmark year in that case, and that was the first year. Last year was the first year where more women than men graduated with medical degrees and graduated with law degrees. So women are passing men in these professional fronts. And in looking at the percentage of each gender that's employed, men in the labor force is actually dropping from about 80% down to only a bit over 70% of men are in the labor force, whereas women have climbed from just over 40% up to 60%. And so there's been a definite gender shift in educational level and in work in terms of labor, who has jobs and how those jobs are going. I'm a cultural historian, so I like looking at cultural things, so I looked at television too, and this is kind of cheating, but somewhat not, right? One of the most popular shows of the 1950s and early 1960s was Father Knows Best, which is pretty self-explanatory about who's the leader of this family. What's interesting is by the time you get to the 1980s, another popular show was Who's the Boss, which is based entirely around the idea of a professional woman hiring a man to be, and not only that, a macho Italian man to be her housekeeper and essentially, and of course, much hilarity and a potential love affair ensues. But what the whole premise of the show is a struggle between the genders over who's really in control. It's interesting, in the early 1980s, you have three really successful movies that all also address this. 9 to 5, right? You have three women take over, like literally take their boss hostage and hide him away and take over the company, and it runs much better. You have Tootsie, where Dustin Hoffman moves from being a male actor to a female actor and does a much better job with women that way, as he tells his love interest at the end, right? I'm a much better man to you as a woman than I ever was as a man. And then you have Michael Keaton playing a father who's laid off, and at the same time his wife is promoted, so he stays home. And as Mr. Mom, it's disastrous, but eventually they come to a good understanding. And so you see this is clearly something that's being discussed and thought about in our culture. By the time you get to the 1980s and on, The Simpsons is still running to this day. And in fact, the Homerification has become a term in cultural studies of what's happened to men. So in the 1950s, the man was always the smart one, right? Think of I Love Lucy, right? Ricky's on top of stuff and Lucy's the dingbat. Get to the 1990s and it's reversed. Homer hasn't a clue, is really a large infant, isn't really capable of doing much. Marge is completely in charge. And certainly that's going to be replicated in the next generation, as Bart is a perpetual adolescent, right? His name anagrams to Brett, after all. He's really not capable of doing much, where Lisa is destined to become president. So we see this gender switch in culture that way, too. Now, I was also curious about advertising, because that certainly is going to impact how and why people buy vehicles. And it's fun when you start reading advertising literature, you kind of feel half revelation and half really dirty and bad about yourself. I've been telling students that if I ever quit this job, I'm going into advertising, because it sounds like a lot of fun in a really soul-selling fun way. So what you see in the 1990s is the Claritas Group, which is one of the most powerful of the advertising. It's an agency that serves advertisers, that gives them data about target markets. And they use the Nielsen ratings to do this. And they've classified all of America into first 66 and now 68 different subgroups. And they give them different names. And these names include like shotguns and pickups, and red, white, and blue, and they all have descriptions with them, right? Shotguns and pickups tend to be young working class couples with large families. More than half have two or more kids living in small homes and manufactured housing. Red, white, and blue, middle-aged with high school educations and lower incomes. Many are transitioning from blue-collar to service industry jobs. In their spare time, they are active members of local community organizations. So these are good, hardworking people who are shifting around, but these are the two groups that auto industries in the 80s and 90s started to target pickup trucks to. And this is a great example.
America is still the land of rugged individualists.
Right, the first line was right, America is still the land of rugged individuals.
I was strong as I could be. I go around.
And this commercial is wonderfully ridiculous, right? I don't know what they just dropped into that truck. I don't know why there's a black Amish woman.
Their Chevy truck. But they all want the same thing. The most dependable, longest-lasting trucks on the road.
And there are ad after ad after ad like that throughout the 80s and the 90s. You can hop on YouTube and watch them. I went to a training site for advertisers, and this was the course on the section of the course that was on selling autos, automobiles. I love this. Pickup trucks are powerful symbols. Ads use sleek images, tough music, and sentimental appeals to and portray stoic men and roaring machines to tap directly into the male brain. They appeal to any man who has wanted to get his hands dirty, flee the city, and have mastery over a machine. They speak directly to the experience of being a working man, and their common theme is that a truck is a tool for work, and the men who own them have important work to do. These ads draw a conscious distinction between the hardworking men who drive trucks and the pencil-pushing office dwellers who do fine with a compact sedan. Truck ads tap into men's desire to be productive, capable, tough, and experienced. Watching a truck as it races next to a herd of stampeding horses or up the side of a rocky mountain suggests that the truck, and by extension the driver, are charged with power. Every man wants to feel like he is strong, relevant, and in control of his destiny. The pickup truck is presented as a tool that can give men that power.
A man will ask a lot of his truck. Can it tow that? Haul this? Make it all the way over the top of that? Well, isn't it nice to know that the answer will always be, hell yes. This is the groundbreaking Ram Heavy
now,
Duty.
Now, this truck is insanely powerful. These heavy duty trucks have a towing capacity of 12 tons. That's a semi. And you'll note by these charts, like full-size pickups, which already have a towing capacity of 6 tons, are the best sellers. And heavy-duty pickups are doing really, really well. They make up for a good chunk of the sales as well. So these are enormous vehicles. Like, that commercial's real. If you buy one of these trucks, you can pull a bulldozer over a sand mountain. I don't know if you ever will need to, but hell yes, you can, right? That's what's important. And in case you are not convinced of my argument, the fact that these exist, I think, really says it all. If you can buy testicles for your truck, it's pretty clear how that truck's gendered. Let's go back to pop culture. Look what a truck means.
Something about a truck in a farmer's field. No trespass sign, time to kill. Nobody's gonna get hurt, so what's the big deal? Something about a truck in a farmer's field.
This song hit number one on the country charts in 2012.
Sitting on ice after a long, hard day.
When Howard and I were doing our book, one of the young men said he bought a Chevy Silverado because of this video. So we're not going to watch the whole video, but the premise here is, as long as you got a truck and you've got beer, you get the girl and everything else in life as well. But foundationally, what you first need is a truck. Now, another song that sort of explains masculinity interestingly with a truck is what happens if you want to destroy a man. Carrie Underwood tells us. You beat up his truck.
Right now, he's probably slow dancing with a bleach blonde tramp, and she's probably getting thirsty. Right now, he's probably buying her some fruity little drink, cause she can't shoot whiskey. Probably up behind her with a blue stick, showing her how to shoot a combo. And he don't know. I take my key into the side of his pretty little souped-up four-wheel drive. Carve my name into his letter sheet. I took a Louisville slugger to both headlights. Slashed her home and all four times.
This is a brand new sensation. This happened to me this summer, right here on Chicago Avenue. Coal rolling, a rolling coal. You put a switch on your pickup truck, dump a really rich mixture in, and it blows smoke all over the place. It's quite impressive. It's illegal now in New Jersey, otherwise you can do it everywhere. New York Times read a story about this in 2016, and what they pointed out was it was a form of rebellion against what the men, at least they interviewed, felt was the oppression of all these movements to try to make them behave in certain ways. It's starkly anti-environmentalist. I love this song, right? Roll, roll, roll your coal, let the Prius see. A big black cloud, the exhaust is loud, now let that greenie be. You can buy this online. Prius repellent, a little sign to put there. So this is pretty clear. They also, the New York Times pointed out that this has a very American, pro-America bent to it too, because pickup trucks, again, are largely manufactured in America. Now, when I gave this lecture last time, I ended with this slide. Last time, meaning I gave this in Croatia a few months ago when I was there on sabbatical, and again to my honors class. And to be frank, it was easy for me as an educated, right-minded, socially responsible, non-pickup driving professor to look at the odd and irrational buying of pickup trucks and to explain it by looking at those other folks, those hillbilly elegy sorts of folks, the Trump-voting discontent white men who haven't fared well in today's modern economy and who are feeling threatened by their better employed, better educated wives, sisters, and daughters, and by the loss of their identity-giving blue-collar jobs. Those men, I reasoned, are bolstering themselves against feelings of declining worth and power by buying a vehicle that embodies all the things they themselves are struggling to be. Powerful, self-sufficient, independent, indomitable, and in charge. To be like a rock. Or, in a word, manly. And I do believe that this is true to some degree. This is happening to some extent, and it does partly explain why pickup truck sales remain so robust in the United States. However, one of my wonderful students, a sharp-minded young Iowan who refuses to suffer fools lightly, especially when those fools are her profs, called me out on this. She was rightfully unwilling to condone this image, which serves as the final image in this presentation. And came to my office and in very kind but in no uncertain terms told me this wasn't okay. And she was right. This conclusion, though there is some merit to it, is academically irresponsible and worse, culturally insensitive at best, and straight up prejudice at worst. And so I went back to the drawing board, and this turned out to be a very good idea. So listen to your students. What I did is I went back into the data and quickly realized that though numbers are hard to nail down for sure, because there isn't strong data that shows the demographics other than by gender of pickup drivers, the sheer numbers of sales show that far more men than just disenchanted blue-collar workers are buying pickups. It was at this point that a chart that I had consulted earlier jumped out at me anew. When I took the data of car sales versus truck sales, I initially added only another graph line showing the dropping agriculture primary abstraction workforce to make sense of it, a line that showed that the need for pickups dropped as their sales increased. But another data set I compared against these cars and truck sales now showed me a different picture, a comparison of sale of the price of gas. When I did sales to the price of gas. And when I did this initially, I largely disregarded this data because it showed really, it didn't show what I wanted it to show. It didn't explain why pickup truck sales kept rising steadily because pickup truck sales moved logically. They were inverse to, for most of the time period, were inverse to gas prices. As gas prices went up, pickup truck sales dropped in the short term, but in the long term, the trend kept going up. But when I went back and looked, I noticed that at the time period where pickup truck sales have really taken off, that actually gas prices stopped being inversely correlated and started to be actually correlated to the price of gas going up. And so this made me think that there's something more going on here, right? As gas prices climbed, there'd been no dip in truck sales. Why was this change? This buying activity is illogical by conventional economic ideas, but it is explained by the ideas of conspicuous consumption, famously outlined by the Norwegian-American economist and sociologist Thurston Veblen in his 1899 book, The Theory of the Leisure Class. Veblen noted that people purchase items they do not need and that are of no practical benefit to them in order to project an image of wealth, power, and status, and that this act of conspicuous consumption flies in the face of normal buying patterns. The less needed and more expensive item will often outsell the more practical, less expensive item. Many economists, sociologists, psychologists, and of course advertisers have built on Veblen's idea. Indeed, it's at the root of what it means to construct a brand name. In automotive terms, one can easily see it in the fact that a Hummer is less comfortable, less reliable, less practical, and more than twice as expensive as a Toyota Land Cruiser, but it is seen as far more desirable because it conveys wealth, power, and status. What the rise in truck sales in parallel with rising gas prices suggests to me is that many of those buying trucks over the past 15 years are those who are able to not have to worry about the price of gas, those who are solidly middle and upper middle class, and are purchasing trucks solely for the status, for status and identity reasons. Now, once I started thinking like this, suddenly things made a good deal more sense, but also became quite a bit less comfortable because I was now talking about me and my successful, well-educated white male peers. Looking in the mirror is easy. Admitting to what you see is hard. But I engaged this and I took a look in the mirror, and this will be embarrassing. When left to my own devices, what I wear is jeans, a t-shirt, a flannel shirt, work boots, and when it's cold, a black leather motorcycle jacket. Why? I'm a history professor. I read and write for a living. Traditionally, my professional uniform is supposed to be what I'm wearing right now, right? Khakis, button-down shirt, loafers. I missed that one. And the only leather I should be wearing is right on a rumpled sports coat for the patches, right? That's supposed to be my uniform. And that's also, of course, another form of conspicuous consumption, right? I'm dressing like a professor, but it's one that I believe that most of my middle-aged peers in academia have largely chafed against. And when I look at my academic peers sitting out there, this gets proved somewhat. I've never seen Steve wear a sports coat, right? And so, indeed, we dress in what our farming and factory working grandfathers wore for their work. And the reason for this is surely multifaceted and debatable, but at base level, I think I can explain it, at least for myself, quite simply. The work I do, sitting around reading and thinking, is what real workers do in their spare time. And I don't want to be perceived as a gentleman, I want to be perceived as a man. Someone who knows how to do real work, but who just happens to be a professor. It's important to my identity that I'm a good professor and academic, that I can research and write and give a convincing argument and an engaging lecture. But it's also important for me that others know that I can rip out walls in my house and remodel my own kitchen, that I raise chickens, that I plant a garden, that I change my own oil, and that I build my own fences and can walk through Lowe's feeling like I know more than those punk kids who are there trying to help me. It's important, in other words, for me to feel self-sufficient, working world competent, powerful, to feel like a man. I'm willing to admit that all of these photos I put up here are photos I've posted on Instagram or Facebook, right? These are clearly the ways I've wanted to portray myself. I found exactly one photo of me actually being a professor in my photos. I mostly put pictures up like this. I think that's important. I know this is a highly problematic way to define manliness, and I'm not suggesting that it is right or good. In fact, I think the image needs to be changed. However, I also know that in my gut, this is still how I culturally understand manhood and masculinity. And I do not believe I'm alone, and I have strong evidence of this. Pickup truck sales. Suddenly it hit me that issues of masculinity in the 21st century cut across educational, professional, and class lines. All the trends about masculinity and truck sales that I've been discussing are every bit as much about me as they are about that guy in the big Trump truck I used at the end of my last lecture. You see this in the popular media fairly recently. This is from 2010, an article called Man Up, Why We Need to Reimagine Masculinity, where gender scholars try to explain what's happening to manhood. Right, the end of men isn't nigh, nor is macho dead, but its definition should be broadened to include both Mr. T and Mr. Mom. I love this. This got a lot of press. The fact that, right, dad staying at home more than doubles, and that certainly looks shocking. This is a great example for my history students of how you lie with statistics. Yes, it's doubled. It's moved from 0.3% to 0.8%. It's the green line there at the bottom. This isn't really a major trend. Slate Magazine ran this article just 2 years ago. The pickup truck has officially been domesticated. This makes sense because studies from 2010 found that more American men than women claim that they want to be parents, and that professional men are more likely than women to describe themselves as family-oriented and to prioritize a strong, loving marriage and children alongside work. Not surprisingly, then, truck ads targeting these men have changed, and suggesting that the ideal modern man is equally capable of hauling boulders and babies, and that now, when it comes to selling trucks, child rearing is kind of a dude thing. Right? This whole article is called "When Did the Rock Solid Manly Men in Truck Commercials Get So Soft?" So I started looking at these ads, and I quickly noticed that they are aimed at me, a middle-class urban dude. Suburban dude. This is from 2012 Super Bowl, back when we were afraid of the Mayan apocalypse. Now notice that there are no women or children in this, but there is a dog lovingly buckled into the back seat to show a caring man. Lots of cultural references, Terminators and aliens.
Where's Dave?
Dave didn't drive the longest lasting, most dependable truck on the road. Dave drove a Ford.
This.
Twinkie?
Yeah.
Looks like we made it.
Chevy Silverado, from the beginning of your workday to the end of the world. Chevy,
I mean, this ad's really fun, but if you look at the print ads at the same time too, you see this idea being expressed, right? Like, this is selling the Ford 350. This is a huge truck, redefining playing in the sandbox, right? It's sort of a kid reference, a dad reference, right? Or, right, when you get an engine that you don't have to order off the kiddie menu. This is sort of a different tack. And for goodness sakes, this ad features Barry Manilow. How did we move from Bob Seger like a rock to Barry Manilow, right? Like, this is a pretty profound shift in advertising. So tough, right? But also defined by being a caring suburban dad. Now, the ad from the next year's Super Bowl was one of the most effective Super Bowl ads ever. Note that, you know, every second in a Super Bowl ad costs tons of money. And note that the first 7 seconds of this is silent, which I remember when watching the Super Bowl got my attention because, when the noise stops, you're curious and you turn around and look. This is from a Paul Harvey address to the future farmers of America from 1978. They just took his speech and illustrated it.
And on the eighth day, God looked down on his planned paradise and said, I need a caretaker. So God made a farmer. God said, I need somebody willing to get up before dawn, milk cows, work all day in the fields, milk cows again, eat supper, then go to town and stay past midnight at a meeting of the school board. So God made a farmer. God said, I need somebody willing to sit up all night with a newborn colt and watch it die. And dry his eyes and say, maybe next year. I need somebody who can shape an axe handle from a persimmon sprout, shoe a horse with a hunk of car tire, who can make harness out of hay, wire, feed sacks, and shoe scraps, who planting time and harvest season will finish his 40-hour week by Tuesday noon, and then paying in from tractor back, put in another 72 hours. So God made a farmer. God said, I need somebody strong enough to clear trees and heave bales, yet gentle enough to yean lambs and wean pigs and tend the pink-combed pullets, who will stop his mower for an hour to splint the broken leg of a meadowlark. So God made a farmer. It had to be somebody who'd plow deep and straight and not cut corners, somebody to seed, weed, feed, breed, and rake, and disc, and plow, and plant, and tie the fleece, and strain the milk, somebody who'd bale a family together with the soft, strong bonds of sharing, who would laugh and then sigh, and then reply with smiling eyes when his son says that he wants to spend his life doing what dad does. So God made a farmer.
Now this is about as America as you can get. This tells American, especially American men, what a real man is, right? Maybe it's just me growing up in Kansas, but the fact that they spent $16 million to run this ad makes me think they weren't just targeting at me. This is a male sentiment in general. Right, this advertising is ostensibly, I guess, to get people to become farmers, but of course that's not true. Nobody rushed out to become a farmer. But the Ram sales went up pretty nicely after this. Their hash, I don't know if you can see their email or their web address is Keep Plowing, which struck me as really funny. Because I don't think anybody who buys this is plowing. The last that I want to show you is from the 2015 Super Bowl. This one's by Chevy. They ran it in two different versions, but the long version was a 2.5 minute version that they ran in about a third of the nation saw the 2.5 minute version, which cost $22.5 million to air, is this. And it's wonderful. It's sort of saying everything I wanted it to say.
Can a truck make you more handsome, more dependable, more rugged? We came here to find out. We talked to real people, not actors. Including kids, mature people, young single women, rich housewives, guys with beards.
Hello, thank you for coming.
We showed them two pictures of the same guy in the same location. The only difference, the vehicle behind him.
Which guy is more handsome?
He left. Drive the truck.
He just looks, you know, more ba-bam.
Which man is sexier?
Truck, yeah.
Which one of these two guys would you rather have date your daughter?
This guy is definitely the guy your mom wants you to marry, and this is the guy you're going to run off to and leave him to be with him.
That truck is going to protect my little girl, and I'm always concerned about getting her home safe.
Show me how a truck guy would shake my hand. Oh.
The guy with the truck would definitely have like a German Shepherd dog. I mean, come on.
Like a tarantula, a rattlesnake.
What kind of pet would this guy have?
Maybe like some birds.
If this guy could grow facial hair, what would he grow?
Just a soul patch.
The truck guy.
Mutton chops.
In a zombie apocalypse.
The truck. What's the matter with you?
Which one is cooler?
He's driving a four-door truck. That says it all. He's living and he's existing.
He's like, yeah, I'm cruising and I'm gonna go to the beach now. And this guy's like, yeah, I'm gonna go home and watch TV.
I'm not sure of the definition of cool, but if it means doing what he wants, when he wants, the guy with the truck.
After 12 groups in 2 days, we learned that truck guys are 85% more handsome.
That one right there has way more sex appeal.
76% more resourceful.
I'm gonna call him. If you're in a jam, call the truck.
And 100% more likely to have an awesome pet.
Timberwolf Husky.
Clearly, people feel strongly about truck guys.
It is the guy.
Now listen to what they tell you about the truck and how nothing of it has to do with what a truck should do, but what would make it nice to own a truck in suburbia.
With built-in 4G LTE Wi-Fi. Best-in-class V6 fuel economy.
It feels like a car.
Advanced safety features.
Wonderful.
And a flexible cargo bed.
That means an itty-bitty cargo bed.
You know you want a truck. The all-new Chevy Colorado.
There you go. So what does all this mean? Here are the facts. I'll start with that because I feel more comfortable. For the past 20 years, pickup sales in the U.S. and Canada have greatly increased. The economic and social roles of women and men are changing rapidly. Women are gaining power and influence. Traditional male jobs are largely gone. Men buy about 85% of pickups, though very few practically need a truck. Manufacturers have shifted their public styles, their pickup styles, and their advertising focus to attract a wider demographic, family men and urban professionals, etc. It's hard to buy a pickup truck now that isn't four-door. They call it a crew cab, but you're not hauling your crew, you're hauling your kids, right? Like, anyway. The number of trucks sold shows that this plan is working. Urban and suburban professionals appear to be buying a significant amount of trucks. My conclusion is this. White men in North America, regardless of class, are experiencing a redefinition of manhood, likely because of factors including the economic and social realities of changes in labor, and because of the increasing economic and cultural power of women. Pickup truck sales have expanded throughout the 21st century among these men because pickups function as a symbol, symbolic reassertion of power, control, and a connectedness to real labor. I thought I'd end with this. I hit Scott up for this. Thank you. So it's hard to get pickup truck data, and it suddenly, like, Scott was like, I've got pickup truck data. I was like, whoa. So in the last 7 years, EMU has issued 9,083 vehicle permits. This is sloppy. I will say this up front. But just in case you're curious, this is what has been registered here at EMU. 62% are cars, 11% are crossovers, only 8% are pickup trucks. And I found it interesting when I broke down the pickup trucks because there was demographic data. Thanks so much. Women here own more trucks than on average or across the nation. It's about two-thirds, one-third women to men. Women one-third, men two-thirds are of truck ownership. EMU, this reflects, the racial demographic, EMU is far higher white than non-white, and so I would need better statistical tools to see how significant this is. But there were only 17 non-white people who had ever registered a pickup truck at EMU. The age breakdown kind of surprised me in that 55 plus was the largest group who owned pickup trucks. Then it was the younger folks. Those who were sort of right in prime child years, it's debatable, but 35 to 45 and 45 to 55 owned the fewest amount of trucks or registered the fewest amount of trucks. I don't know what all that means, and that's where I'm going to end and take questions. Thanks.
I wonder, the percentage of trucks was only, 8% or something? And nationally, what's the percentage?
Of full truck ownership? So, okay, again, this gets... I don't know. The statistics we have, or I was able to find, are only about sales. Ownership, like what would be really super helpful to me is if like I could get the DMV of a few major states to tell me who registered every vehicle. The problem is though too, like just who registers it isn't necessarily who drives it. So that's why this information is so tricky to get. Other than doing your own poll in some way, I haven't been able to ascertain that. But it, just judging by straight sales, a lot. This is low for pickup trucks here at EMU. Yeah.
Mark, one thing that I did not see in your presentation that I see all around here is the pickup truck with the gun across the back and the Confederate flag.
Yes, those certainly exist. And that is what, honestly, I guess that's what I was expecting. But when Howard and I did the book, what we quickly found was that certainly isn't the descriptor of most pickup owners. I would argue it's more... It's an iconic, it's a stereotype. It's an iconic image that we have, right? I mean, because like if you put it in reverse, it becomes really funny. Like if you saw a Prius with a gun rack and a Confederate flag, that would be weird. Just the other day, I saw a pickup truck drive by with a Confederate flag waving behind it, but the Confederate flag was in rainbow colors. I still don't know what to do with that. I almost cheered, but then I wasn't sure. But right, these are potent symbols. And I guess that's the other thing is a pickup truck has become a symbol. Like driving a truck does mean something. And incidentally, driving a Prius also means something, right? Incidentally, that's why Prius sales have eclipsed all of the other hybrids is not because it's a better vehicle, but because it looks weird. If you're gonna spend the cash to buy a hybrid vehicle, you want people to know that you're cool and green. So you buy one that looks weird. My kids, we own a Prius. My kids got me this bumper sticker for Christmas. Actually, I think my wife, Fairly, is the one who saw it and got them to buy it. I was pumped to put this on my car. But if you think about what this symbolically means, like what I'm basically saying is I'm cool enough to drive a Prius and know it's not cool, which is what makes me cool, right?
Mark, I have a quick question that I'm still trying to work through a little bit. But so if you're thinking about changing views of masculinity or masculinity being threatened, sort of driving this truck boom, I guess, how do we know that like the causal relationship almost isn't the other way? Like maybe the truck market, they're just fantastic marketers. They're just better than everyone else, right? And that it's sort of, it has kind of just like built on itself in a way that forms this association. Like in the Chevy commercial, that doesn't necessarily say to me like kids think Toyota drivers just own fish, but just like the truck manufacturers have done an exceptional job of linking, like forming this image in a way that like other manufacturers haven't.
Right. And I would love to talk, like, I don't know, right. As everybody knows, correlation's easy to show, causality is almost impossible to show. And I don't have a good way of responding to that because it's a question I've certainly asked and thought about. Because there's been a lot of resurgence of manly things in general. A new term, retrosexual, which is a response to metrosexual, right? Why hipsters now have beards and are wearing flannel instead of wearing penny loafers and tight jeans, right? This lumberjack chic that's come back. That hasn't been driven as much by advertising campaign, but seems to have come back anyway. There's something else I was going to say that just blew out of my mind. This is a problem. I mean, this is why I realized why maybe I normally stick to 19th century history and not contemporary history is I don't know how to answer a lot of these questions. And cultural historians always wind up with these things. Like, I don't know. The ads are certainly effective. But pickup truck sales kept going up all through 2017. But do you know what the hot pickup truck ad of the Super Bowl of 2017 was? I mean, this was what freaked me out. There weren't any. There wasn't a single ad for a pickup truck in the 2017 Super Bowl. There were two ads for Alfa Romeo sports cars. So that kind of gets to this, like pickup truck sales continue to climb. Oh, and I know what I was gonna say. There's an interesting other trend that's been happening since the 70s working class has become increasingly cool. This is when country music starts to take off in the United States so that people who aren't country folk start to embrace this country image. People throw rebel flags on their cars that really, in their minds, aren't supporting anything about the Confederacy, but something more about this hell yeah sort of thing. And country music starts to take off at the same time as pickup truck sales. Like that is also sort of linked, right? You see this go together. And so, this is why I think it has something to do with dudes working in cubicles feeling like they need something else to represent them. Yeah.
When you were showing the ads about trucks and masculinity, it made me think back 40 years ago, the Marlboro Man on a horse was a tremendous symbol. And I don't really know, but it'd be interesting to trace what happened to the sales of that particular brand of cigarettes as opposed to Winston's or Salem's or I don't know what other kinds were.
Right.
But advertising does have that important thing. But I think behind it is why did the marketers choose a pickup truck as the masculine image? Because I think you're right on that it is.
This idea in America, America and Canada have been somewhat unique in that, I actually had a slide for this. I put a lot of slides in that, right, what a man looks like in America, like if you want to look like a powerful man, it traditionally, I'm pushing this over the top, right, like in Europe, traditionally, like, if you were a powerful man, you dressed as froofy as possible, right? I mean, you wore tights and stuff. And even at that time period, the American leaders pushed back against this, right? Like, this is Franklin wearing a coonskin hat. This was his official, this is the portrait he paid the money to have produced. This was Jefferson's official portrait. This is how he wanted to be portrayed. This is the equivalent of having a president be painted in this sort of outfit. Right? This has been something that Americans have held up as a powerful man in America looks different. It means that they're working class, that, right, that we want our candidates to come from a log cabin for some reason, right? We want that. Now, you know, other countries do it in some weird ways too, but you're right. There's something about rugged masculinity that, and so, right, the Winston, the Marlboro man on a horse is the same impulse, except we don't drive horses anymore, right? We save a horse. We drive a pickup truck. We do wear cowboy hats. Although, gimme caps are more right now, right? The baseball cap has become sort of the new symbol that way. And that's incidentally something hipsters in New York are wearing, right? Like, they've got their John Deere hat on, and that's super cool. Yeah. All right. Thanks.
Thanks a lot, Mark. It was very interesting. I'm sure you've thought of other questions you'd like to talk about, so I invite you to head over to Common Grounds, and we'll have a chance to chat more informally over a few munchies. Next month, again, third Wednesday. Can anybody remind me who next month's speaker is? I should have checked that before I came. Anyway, see you back here next month. Check out one of the posters that's hanging all over campus.